Let me introduce my next guest by restating what Peter Doherty, our friend Peter, had to say about him and his book that we're about to discuss. Mnuchin shows us just how dangerous it can be when emotion drives good people to abandon critical thinking. Okay, to vaccinate or not to vaccinate, it's a debate that simmered for many decades. And then in 1998, a controversial British scientist, Andrew Wakefield, made a shocking allegation that certain vaccines like mumps, rubella and measles might cause autism. The world gasped and a devastating health scare started. Now, Wakefield's research was challenged from the outset, and various studies that followed failed to find any link between these childhood vaccines and autism. The study was retracted last year, and Wakefield's medical license was stripped. But the damage was done, and the myth that vaccines cause disorders continues even today. How do people come to believe and promote ideas that are false? Author Seth Mnuchin has been investigating the subject, and in fact, he's done most of the work on it, and has put together his findings in his new book called The Panic Virus: Fear, Myth and the Vaccination Debate. And he's on the Blower from New York. Welcome, Seth, and congratulations. You describe the Wakefield saga as a deliberate campaign of misinformation. Motivated by what?
Well, it's an excellent question. Wakefield, in the period just before he published this paper in 1998, had been working with a law firm, with a solicitor in the UK, who was involved with parents who believed their children had been injured by vaccines. So that was one connection he had, obviously, beforehand. He also had filed a patent for an alternative measles vaccine in the months before he published his paper. So obviously the implication there was that if there were concerns raised about the MMR vaccine, he would have potentially been in a place to benefit from those fears if he was able to bring an alternative product to market.
Now, the findings, such as they were based on his study of 12 children, and as you point out right from the beginning, the Lancet was distancing itself from the research. It published a very harsh critique alongside the study.
Yeah, what's interesting to me is a lot of the criticism since the sort of shoddiness of Wakefield's work has come out, a lot of the criticism has been directed towards the Lancet. Why would they publish a paper of this quality in the first place? Shouldn't their peer review have picked up more of the problems? And I'm actually probably more sympathetic to the Lancet than a lot of places, because I believe that you need the academic freedom to publish bad work.
Well, that's very very gracious of you, Seth. But
I mean, that's how science advances. You have good studies and bad studies, and it sort of creeps along.
But in this case, it led to catastrophe. As a consequence, immunization rates on both sides of the Atlantic dropped. I think they dropped here as well. Outbreaks of measles, yeah, mumps increased, and kids died of vaccine-preventable diseases.
Well, I think what really should have happened differently here is the media response. From the get-go, from the day that Wakefield announced the results of his paper, was along the lines of, prominent researcher says parents should be wary of giving their children the MMR jab.
So there was a tabloid media response.
It was a tabloid response. It was very much an either or on the one hand, on the other hand, you have Andrew Wakefield versus other experts, and when you present it like that, it sounds like sort of a 50-50 split. And as you mentioned at the outset, you know, this was 12 children. Making conclusions on a 12-child case study, even if it had turned out that there were not all these other problems with his research, is preposterous. Making population-wide conclusions based on that is ridiculous. It would be like if you knew a family with 10 kids, 7 of whom were boys, then claiming that 70% of the population was going to be male. So it didn't take, or it shouldn't have taken, a lot of scientific expertise on the part of the press to be able to frame that story in a different light. But of course,
I see, in fact, we've commented endlessly on this program, something similar going on with the odd and very ratbaggy studies, quote unquote, that, you know, are picked up by the media as evidence that climate change is a myth, that it's, you know, that it's nonsense, and they suddenly give equivalence to the odd eccentric,
right,
as opposed to the great body of work by serious science.
Absolutely, I think that the false sense of equivalency and the sort of way that the press can use their claim that they need to be quote fair to both sides as a dodge for publishing these kind of fantastic claims. I think you see that all the time. Climate change is an excellent example. It would be akin to if I said the Earth is flat, and then you said, okay, well then we better have a show about this. We'll have you, and then we'll have an astronomer on next to you, and you two can have it out.
We'll do that next week, Seth. I didn't realize
you were
a flat earther.
you see it in science a lot, but you don't just see it in science. I mean, in our country, there was what was called the quote birther movement that claimed that Barack Obama was not born in the United States and so wasn't eligible to be president. Now, you know, that's an absolute fantasy. I mean, that's
well,
outrageous.
The 9/11 mob are the ones that fascinate me. In fact, I'm under an ongoing death threat from a 9/11 believer because I've suggested that it's faintly ridiculous. But the thing that makes this different is a lot of this stuff percolates on the net, on the web. You know,
right.
Andrew Wakefield was in The Lancet. You've got to come back to this, don't you? You've really got to, you know, this might have been a web phenomenon once it got going, but The Lancet launched it.
Well, that specific article certainly launched that aspect of it, although then the next year there were sort of these two strains of vaccine hysteria. One was about the MMR vaccine. The other was about a mercury-based preservative that has since been removed, but there was some concern about that in the late 90s. But yes, it's true that article in The Lancet did launch it initially. But, you know, again, if you went through all of the medical journals published in a given month, there are articles about pain management, there are articles about heart disease, there are articles about developmental disorders, and some of them end up being borne out by later research and some don't. You know, there are articles all the time about different vaccines and what side effects may or may not be. There were a couple of reasons why this one really seized hold. One, I think, is the media. Two is because we still know so little about autism.
Well, I was going to raise that. It's so enigmatic and so mysterious that it was fallow ground.
Exactly. It's enigmatic and mysterious, and it's almost like cancer in that there don't seem to be any good prospects on the immediate horizon for either figuring out its etiology or determining what might be an effective cure.
Yeah.
And then the final piece of this puzzle is that vaccines were in some ways a victim of their own success.
I want to come to that in a minute because that's a very important issue. But another factor I would have thought is that very often parents with autistic kids feel guilty. They think it's something they did. So here's an opportunity to point the finger elsewhere.
Well, there's the sort of history and the current phenomena of parents and their relationship in terms of blame or guilt with autism is fascinating. And for years, for decades, the dominant paradigm through which autism was viewed was through this theory called the, quote, refrigerator mother theory, which was essentially that autistic children were the result of being born to mothers who were too emotionally frigid to raise them to become productive adults. So There's a long history of parents being blamed for
not just mothers. I remember reading a statistical study which purported to demonstrate that the children of engineers, engineer fathers, were more likely. Once again, it's a bit like the mother argument, isn't it? That engineers were seen as fairly cold and calculating.
Right. Right, and there have been studies saying that children born to academics are more likely. So there for decades it was really there was a focus on it was a very Freudian notion of being able to locate psychological precedent to actual disease or actual
disorder. Well, of course,
the
whole New Age and alternative medicine field tends to see illness not as a metaphor, but as some sort of punishment for psychic inadequacies. You know, there's a lot of blame game going on, isn't there?
Yes, well, and not just, I mean, not just alternative medicine. I think you see it creeping into the mainstream a lot. I know that Oprah Winfrey was just out there in the last couple of months, and she features people on her show all the time who kind of preach this. It's like the secret. That philosophy, the secret, where essentially if you live the life that you are supposed to be living, everything else will work out. You'll be healthy. You will have a good job. You'll have a successful marriage. And that, of course, can be a horribly damaging sort of philosophy to spread, because think about what that says to people who aren't healthy or who don't have a satisfying job. It essentially tells them that this is somehow your fault, that you're doing something wrong in your life, and that's why you're not happy, or that's why you're sick.
Well, it's one of the reasons I don't like Oprah Winfrey. Okay, now, Wakefield's arguments exploded. The anti-vaccine lobby is nonetheless still powerful, and there's some evidence that it's still growing.
Yes, it's something that when it took hold, it's been very, very hard to then sort of eradicate. And it's one of the reasons that I called the book The Panic Virus. I realized that one of the things we see here is that when a fear takes hold, it's much, much more difficult to unscare people than it is to scare them initially. It's sort of like there's a old political saying here where or story, I guess, about two candidates in a debate, and one candidate says, "Well, I have no reason to believe that my opponent is beating his wife." And of course, then all anyone can think about is whether or not his opponent is being abusive to his partner. So I think you see that anytime you get a scare going on. And once you have sort of planted in parents' minds, vaccines might be harming your children, it's almost impossible to get rid of that fear. And I think you add to that, you know, still the method, the ways in which vaccines work, remains very mysterious to people.
Yeah. Well, let's get back to the point you tried to make earlier about immunizations have become victims of their own success. Let's deal with that paradox.
Yes. Well, yes, exactly. Because when you are in a situation in which a disease is endemic and you know people who are dying of polio or who have been blinded by measles, you very much want a vaccine. When you get into a situation where you have a generation or two of people who have not seen their peers in iron lungs, and don't know children that have been maimed by vaccine-preventable diseases, then all of a sudden the risk of not vaccinating seems very notional. And if you start to have concerns that there are real risks to vaccinating, it sort of seems like a no-brainer. You know, why would I subject my child to something where there is a risk, where it really doesn't seem like not doing that could have any potential consequences?
Tell the listeners, who are mainly living in Australia, the story of Dana Elizabeth McCaffrey, the little Australian girl who died of whooping cough when she was just 32 days old.
Yeah, it's such a sad story, and I remain in touch with the McCaffreys, and they're really wonderful people. They their daughter Elizabeth was born a couple of years ago, and she started developing a cough. And so they took her back and forth to the doctor, to the hospital a couple of times. They did not know at the time that they happened to be living in an alternative area where there was actually very high unvaccination rates. And by the time they discovered that Dana had pertussis, that she had whooping cough, it had already advanced to such a state that there was very little they could do. And they airlifted her to a hospital and were trying to give her a blood transfusion, and she died. And one of the things I think that is really so striking about the McCaffreys is that they have been very, very outspoken about the need to educate people about vaccines, about the fact that adults need to get vaccine boosters. And as a result of this, they've taken an enormous amount of abuse from different anti-vaccine forces in Australia. And I think they really have been incredibly courageous, because it's not something that it's not a campaign that, you know, they needed, and it's certainly not what they were looking for in the weeks and months after the death of their daughter and grieving the death of their daughter. But they really have been very, very determined, and I think have started to affect some change and change people's perceptions.
I'm talking to Seth Manoukian, journalist and author. He's written a marvellous book on fear and panic over vaccinations. And this is LNL on ABC Radio National, Radio Australia and the World Wide Web and its various manifestations. Now, how did you get involved in the topic? I understand that you were newly married and thinking about having kids.
Yeah, it was, I guess it was about now, it was over 3 years ago, and my wife and I had moved into a neighborhood where there were a lot of young families, or young about-to-be families, and we started hearing about this concern that vaccines might cause autism. And we started hearing about, our friends, couples, debate whether to give this or that vaccine. And it wasn't a topic that had really been on my radar. And what fascinated me so much at the time was I was amazed that so many people were making decisions based on really instinct and emotion, what they said.
And you're talking about well-educated professionals.
Yeah, lawyers, journalists, doctors, computer programmers, some people who actually worked in healthcare. So I was very struck by that. And at the time, I didn't know which side was, you know, sort of right. I didn't have a clear sense of that. But I was very struck that this was a group of people for whom, you know, you were talking about climate change, this was a group of people who were incredibly disdainful of anyone who ignored the evidence about climate change. And yet in this regard, they were willing to make their decisions based totally on what they, quote, felt was right. So that was what started my investigating it. At the time, I did not realize how emotional an issue, I guess, it is. I think here and over there, it's taken on some of the tenor of abortion debates. You know, there are death threats. There are, and I guess in retrospect, it does make sense, because anytime you deal with children's health, and anytime you deal with the situation that involves parents caring for their kids, things can get very emotional.
Tell us about meeting Wakefield. I'm surprised that he gave you quite a lot of access.
Mm.
What impression did you have of this bloke? Did he seem to you a charlatan, or did he seem sincere?
Well, the first time I met him was at a conference of an anti-vaccine conference, and he was very much in his element. He was in the atrium of a hotel when I was interviewing him, and admirers were coming up to him and thanking him for the work he had done for their children, and he was sort of leaning back with his shirt a little bit unbuttoned, and I definitely could see he's a very charismatic guy. He's tall and sort of rugged looking, and I understand his appeal, and I definitely understand his appeal, the appeal of his message, which is not only, it's important to say, it's not only that he knows what caused autism, but he also says that he has cures for autism, based on his belief of what causes it. So I definitely sensed why people were drawn to him. Over time, he became less confident, or it seemed to me he became less confident. And the last time I interviewed him was right after he had actually lost his UK medical license for some of the experiments he had done on children and some of the ways he had done his research. And at that point, he seemed very, he seemed almost confused, and at one point asked me to, if I was interested in translating his book into Hebrew, which was so bizarre to me, because I don't speak Hebrew, and I had never had a conversation with him about translating or anything else. So he seemed to have kind of lost some of his mojo by that point.
Has he ever apologized? Has he ever said, sorry, I got it wrong? Or is he still sustaining his delusion?
No, yeah, he's been totally unrepentant. He insists, in fact, he seems to grow stronger in his insistence that this is the result of a broad international conspiracy against him, of which I am now a part, according to him.
Well, you're probably a member of Mossad too, aren't you?
Yes, right, exactly, right, exactly. I know. When I was trying to, they said, "Well, was it? Does he think you're part of the international Jewish pharmaceutical conspiracy?" what was it that was going on? But no, he's become more insistent that this is an attempt to silence him.
And the movement's now got a martyr in effect, hasn't it?
Yes, yes, definitely. And they speak of him very much in that language, that he's someone who sacrificed his career, his job, and his reputation in order to protect their children. And that's the storyline that he goes with. He says that governments around the world are too afraid to admit that they got this wrong and that they had injured, thousands and potentially tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of children. And so they have taken part in this conspiracy with the drug companies and the media around the world. And anyone who's worked in the media or worked in government knows how inept and incompetent those two institutions can be in the concept of a worldwide conspiracy where every government in the world is able to work this out and then also coordinate it with every media entity in the world. He certainly gives people a lot of credit.
In a way, it's the odd thing is that he's from the UK. This is much more a USA-sounding phenomenon. And this program during the Bush years again and again came back to the anti-science movement that was coming out of the White House, for heaven's sake.
Right, yes. And certainly there has been very problematic policies towards science in the United States for over the last decade. I think that one of the things that happened here, and in fact we saw much, much bigger results or much bigger repercussions of this in the UK right off the bat, and that's because the UK does not have mandatory vaccination laws. And that's a remnant from some social unrest in the 19th century. But the UK has recommendations, but unlike the US, they don't have school-age laws. And so when Wakefield initially talked about, you know, his fears about the MMR vaccine, the drop in vaccination rates there was pretty immediate. Whereas in the U.S., it took much longer to take hold because initially there were, 10 years ago or 15 years ago, there were primarily only what was known as religious exemptions.
Yeah.
And as time went on, now there are more and more states have instituted what's called a philosophical exemption. And I think you have a similar thing there where in order for a child not to get vaccinated, the parent needs to have a conversation with the doctor and then sign something saying they've had a conversation with the doctor and that they know the risks.
In my ongoing correspondence, largely through email, with the 9/11 conspiracy theorists, which I've now terminated because it's so exhausting, one can have some sympathy for them. Their deep suspicion of the Bush administration is understandable in the light of, say, the WMD lies. But extrapolating that to the notion that the Bush administration knocked over the towers is a bit of an ask. Now, similarly, with people who are suspicious about vaccination, there's the hostility towards Big Pharma is understandable because the giant pharmaceutical organizations have got some problems to face up to, some ethical problems of their own.
Absolutely. And in fact, what I say all the time is I don't want to be put in a position where it sounds like I'm defending drug companies. You know, we have plenty of very good reasons to be suspicious of their motives bringing new products to the market, to be suspicious of studies that are funded by drug companies. But fortunately, when it comes to vaccines, we are not in a position where we need to just take the word of the drug companies.
I've got to wind it up, Seth. I've got to wind it up. Thank you for speaking to me in your flawless Hebrew. Seth Mnookin's new book is called The Panic Virus, A True Story of Medicine, Science and Fear. It's a black ink publication. On our next, we'll be talking to Satyajit Das, our regular finance correspondent, and to award-winning journalist Jonathan Franklin, who had an unprecedented access to the front line of the Chilean mining disaster. And I'd like you to stick around now on ABC Radio National for the news, and I apologise for getting my Canberra host name wrong. I've now found the note. It's a fine organisation, the Medical Association for the Prevention of War. See you next time.